A soft breeze interrupts your thoughts, bringing you back to the peaceful banks of the Sava. You are seated under the shade of an ancient ash tree, just on the gentle slope of the hill leading down from the dirt road which tracks the river. You are almost entranced once more by the beauty of the blue-green waters of the Sava, flowing past just beyond your feet on its long journey through Lower Pannonia. But you successfully snap out of it, to grab some cords of nettle which you had been drying in the sun. Carefully, you braid the small bands of twine, being sure not to snap the delicate strands, and attach it to an iron hook. Satisfied with your creation, you coil the rope and throw it into the water before slowly dragging it back in. "Fishing again, are you?" you hear a voice call from behind you. You turn away from the glowing waters to see a familiar face, a local Avar who frequents this route. In your childhood, you would have feared the Avars, with your family possessing many tales of their brutality in extracting payment. Now, however, this man is cautiously accepted, having converted to Christianity around the same time as your own family, about a decade ago. "I'm sorry to say that I've got none to offer, for you or myself," you respond. "That's quite all right. I only strayed from the road to tell you of the summons of our Prince Ludovit. Men will likely be gathering the warband tomorrow to march against the Franks." This news took you off guard for a second, before you quickly accepted it. After throwing off the Avars in your childhood, you had remembered the abundance of new people suddenly crossing these paths. Those same people who you could consider friends one year would turn out to be enemies the next. As for the Franks, you had remembered seeing their men long ago during the campaigns against the Avars. They were there, along with the Croats of Dalmatia, the Carantanians, and your own men. It was hard to know what to think of all these peoples. Franks, Serbs, Bulgars, Latins. You had even heard rumors of a Roman of Constantinople, passing by only a few months ago. You turn back to the Sava, its comforting waters flowing just as undisturbed as ever. Couldn't it too feel the anarchy around it? Back to Between the Seas. Last time, we covered the fall of the Carolingians and the collapse of the Frankish Empire in the early 900s. Today, we're going to rewind back to the times of Charlemagne and look at the 9th century from the perspective of those people suddenly freed from Avar dominion after their collapse in the 790s. Even more, we will focus specifically on those people of the northern Dinaric range, living in Istria, Dalmatia, and what will be called Lower Pannonia, the land between the Dinaric Mountains and the Danube River. Our story today took place in a region known as Slavonia, bounded by the Sava and Drava rivers within Lower Pannonia. It today makes up a large part of eastern Croatia, and we will see the beginnings of this union much later in the episode. The collapse of the Avars would create an anarchy of sorts in the region, leading to a true borderland as the various powers around them attempted to assert their own influences. The lessons learned in this borderland will be a common theme for the history of Inner Europe, and it offers one of the first recorded examples of such a situation within the region for its medieval cultures. The communities here will begin to weave this frontier tradition into their very identity, an identity that will, in turn, spread throughout the future contested areas of Inner Europe, until it forms a colorful part of the overall tapestry. But let's focus back in on this Dinaric region of Carpathia. So far in the podcast, it has mostly been on the periphery of the story, with the main focus being placed on the Danubian regions of Carpathia and on the plateau. It is important, though, for serving as one of the main frontiers of Inner Europe, a place where people and ideas can enter and leave, through the habitable passes of modern Slovenia, and along the coast from Dalmatia. Here, the Eastern Alps, which separate the plateau from the Mediterranean world of Italy, meet the Julian and Dinaric Alps, which continue down along the west coast of the Balkan Peninsula. The Dinaric Alps are quite unique in their composition, and are easily recognizable through their limestone and dolomite rocks, which often rise steeply from the ground. The geological phenomenon of karst formations means that the surface can be porous in many places, and water often runs below the ground rather than above it. As is common with these limestone-inundated karst regions, sinkholes and caves are widespread, while above-ground sources of water become very valuable. The rarity of mountain passes inland, and the patchy, non-contiguous, desirable land, translate to a region filled with strategic choke points, and also one with widespread lack of control. Bandits and pirates were a common sight in the mountains, and along the more isolated stretches of coast, as we will see later on. The nature of the Dinaric Alps creates a small, arid stretch of land along the Adriatic Sea, between the mountains and the coast. As water was and would remain one of the primary highways for people and commerce, this region would come to be more heavily associated with the Mediterranean world, especially with the Latins. Several trading cities inhabited by Latin Romans would spring up and hold on to their identity throughout the Slavic invasions. The mountains would be the barrier between the regulated Mediterranean climate of the coast and the more variable continental climate of Pannonia. During the Avar and Slavic invasions, the regions in Pannonia would be fully settled by the newcomers, including both the widespread Avar population as well as those families of the Sclavini, who inhabited land all across the peninsula. During the major revolts of the 7th century, the Avar presence in the region was diminished by invading Croatians, who had likely migrated from north of the Carpathians. The Croats carried some connections to the Byzantines, but remained uncontrolled by them and pagan in practice. The Croats would integrate with the other Slavs in the area, soon becoming their dominant aristocracy and uniting them as a unique people. They, along with their predecessors, would invade the Adriatic coastal region, which we will call Dalmatia. Dalmatia has been a name applied to several differently sized stretches of land throughout history, with everything ranging from the entirety of modern Croatia and Bosnia down to a very specific section of the Adriatic coast. Here, we will use it to speak of the narrow coastal region stretching from the Istrian Peninsula down to the coast of modern Montenegro, for simplicity. Istria is another sub-region in the area, and is the name for an arrow-shaped peninsula which juts out into the northern Adriatic, making up the northwest border of modern Croatia today. Back to the Slavic invasions. The Roman cities would largely hold out on the coast, but be forced to contract their influence to many of the shattered coastal islands in the cities themselves, with the Dalmatian countryside largely being claimed by the Slavs. They would continue to launch raids for the next few centuries, including piracy on the Latin and Byzantine commerce of the Adriatic. East of the Dinaric Range, we get into Inner Europe proper, into another region known by many names. The land here is defined by its rivers, with the main two being the Sava and the Drava, which flow down from the northwest to eventually meet with the Danube at Belgrade and Sirmium, modern Srem, respectively. The Sava would form the cores of Slavic civilizations on this side, and the modern capitals of Ljubljana, Zagreb, and Belgrade, with many more towns along the way. It would technically form a subregion of the larger Pannonian Basin, and Lower Pannonia is another term which has been used to describe this region as well as the flatlands further north. Its life-giving waters, temperate rolling hills, and fertile lowlands will remain desirable during these future times of anarchy. So, with the setting established, let's introduce the political background of the region by the start of the 9th century. Since the dissolution of the West, the region has largely remained in the Latin camp of influence, despite being under formal Byzantine control. In fact, one of the last legitimate claimants to the Western emperorship resided in Dalmatia during the late 5th century. Since then, it would largely remain in the Italian sphere of influence, with the Ostrogoths establishing control during their conquest of Italy. Because of this, the Byzantines would make the region a key priority during their reconquest of Italy under Justinian, and strengthen many forts along its rivers so as to protect them from barbarian raids in their supply lines. When the squabbling Lombards and Gepids threatened this vital connection, the Byzantines would invite the Avars to help, though this would backfire tremendously, with the Avars and their Slavic allies fully overrunning the region and pushing the Lombards into northern Italy, where they would then create their own kingdom. This is where we get the narrative of the Slavic and Croatian invasions mentioned before. They would also push into Istria, though this remained their furthest extent, as they were stopped by the denser settlements in northern Italy. Just north, on the passes between the Julian and Dinaric Alps, the Carantanians would settle. Like the Croats, they would form an independent Slavic power in the region, and they were able to hold on to control of this strategic passageway, along with much of the Eastern Alps, for almost 2 centuries, before losing their full independence to the Bavarians in the 740s. Despite their submission, however, they would retain local rulership and much autonomy, and help to form the Frankish military frontier against those powers further east. It is here that we reach the Frankish campaigns against the Avars in the 790s. Charlemagne himself would lead a campaign along the Danube and score several important victories, but the main push into Avar land would actually come from Italy. Charlemagne had established Italy as an autonomous kingdom within the empire after his initial conquest by placing it under his son Pepin. This maintained many aspects of Lombard rule, as their kingdom retained its identity even under Frankish rule. This included aspects such as their famous Iron Crown, as well as their unique and well-armored military forces. It also largely retained their administrative structure. Perhaps the most important subdivision of the Lombard kingdom was its Duchy of Friuli. This was an extensive grant of administration that covered a large part of northeast Italy, and, at times, its military forces could rival those of the king himself. The Duke of Friuli had tried to revolt against Charlemagne after his initial conquest, attempting to take the Lombard cause and have himself crowned. This revolt failed, though, and Charlemagne would replace the local Lombard leadership with appointed Frankish men, sent over from the Rhine. It would also be reorganized into the March of Friuli, which greatly strengthened its military capabilities as a border region of Italy. We will talk more about what the March system means later, as it will be one of the more important types of subdivisions in medieval history. But for now, we can know that this title came with several military privileges, as well as more autonomy. To further strengthen its role as the protector of Italy, the March would be granted lands in the contested Istria, which had been under its own different Marcher rule. It would be this March of Friuli and the Lombard king Pepin who would lead the attack on the Avars. As part of their offensive, they would recruit through their border contacts the Slavic prince of Lower Pannonia, a man named Vojnimir. If the March of Friuli was the first character of our more focused story today, the princedom of Lower Pannonia will be number two. Vojnimir would lead several of his own forces in revolt against the Avars, who maintained tributaries among the Slavs. Together with the men of Friuli, they would defeat the Avars and capture their base of power, fully collapsing their authority west of the Danube Bend, which divides Pannonia. This would be combined with later attacks by the Bulgars, who, under the ambitious Khan Krum, would take the other half of Avar dominion, conquering all of Transylvania, and coming to have a border with the new Frankish conquests on either the Danube or Tisza rivers. We will talk more about the development of the Bulgars and the Serbs in an episode next series, but as far as today goes, they will form the mysterious Eastern Power, character 3 of our story. The remains of the Avars on the Frankish side would be split between the March of Friuli, which would claim overlordship over Vojnimir and his Pannonian Slavs, and the Stem Duchy of Bavaria, who, along with overlordship of the Carantanians, would also expand down the Danube to control what was known as Upper Pannonia. The Bavarians and the wider German Franks will form character 4 of our story. Christianity would be the key to maintaining power in this region, as it would form an administrative apparatus and support the cause of the emperorship. Luckily for the Franks, two archbishoprics on the border would be looking to expand in the cause of evangelization. These were the Archbishopric of Salzburg, corresponding to Bavaria, and the Patriarchate of Aquileia, corresponding to the March of Friuli. The Patriarch of Aquileia could be considered the second most important clerical figure in Italy, after the Pope himself. And at this time, this seat was occupied by a man known as Paulinus, later to be known as St. Paulinus II, the Apostle to the Slovenes. He, along with his peer Arno of Salzburg, would, together with other church officials, hold a ceremony on the Danube, where they divided the new lands between their two administrations. They were both part of Charlemagne's inner circle of learned men, and both good friends with the Anglo-Saxon cleric Alcuin of York. Like Alcuin, they promoted peaceful Christianization, and during this time would work with local rulers to establish churches throughout the lands, and convert all those willing, with a focus on the aristocracy. Vojnimir himself would convert, and promote the Christianization of the people of Lower Pannonia. Several leading Avars would also convert, and they themselves would be allowed to maintain a march of their own, which ruled as an autonomous Christian cognate. They would be positioned by the Franks to protect the Danube frontier from the Bulgars, who had begun to launch probing raids into Pannonia. This would be the height of Frankish influence in the region, and the seeming total victory would soon begin to show cracks through the resentment of the local population. To many, they had thrown off one master, just to elect another. And this brings us to an important point about control, especially in the early medieval period. It's easy to imagine control by states through the visualization of borders on maps. Those on this side of the border owe loyalty and taxes to this person, and those on the other to that person, and so on. This is how I automatically think when imagining political history. The reality of control during the Middle Ages, though, would be much more complex, and yet also more simple. We can imagine control in this time as consisting of two terms, access and influence. Due to the rise of the aristocracies, building relationships with certain clans who held power bases within certain localities became the primary political skill. As mentioned in the past two episodes, when relationships were good, the aristocracy would become an effective bureaucracy, able to mobilize significant resources from the populations it held sway over. Due to these personalized administrations, geographical control was conceptualized less with regions and borders, and more with controlling access to certain populations. To simplify the relationship of the ruler to the aristocracy, good relations with specific clans meant access to their retinues and their local levies. Good relations with figures in the church meant access to their populations for taxation and legitimacy. Geographically, the strategy would be to maintain access to key populations, as well as access to key trade routes or paths for the leader's retinue. Boundaries were not formally set, and maps were not understood in the same way that they are today. As an example, while we often see rivers today as defendable borders that can unambiguously separate one realm or culture from another, rivers, for most of Inner Europe's history, would be the highways connecting populations of a river valley to the outside world. Thus, the strategy would be not to define the river as a border, but rather to ensure access along the river, so as to hold more influence with the populations of the river valleys than your rivals. Likewise, rather than accept mountain ranges as set borders to delineate realms, the focus would be to push for influence over the elites of specific mountain passes, which would be locations of extreme importance for trade and military purposes. This was because these passes allowed access to separated populations, who could be beneficial to the ruler, should their support suddenly be needed. Influence, as a term, refers to sway over these populations. Primary influence of populations remained with the local powers that be, whether they be the church, aristocracy, merchants, or village leadership. And so, access to these populations could easily sway depending on who held more influence over these elites. Influence over the populations themselves usually declined the more relationships there were that blocked the ruling power from them. Formal vassal contracts and fiefs would attempt to make this relationship less fickle and shifty, but would only go so far. Control would remain an extremely personal game for the entire duration of the Middle Ages. This style of personal politics was doubly important within Inner Europe when compared to Maritime and Mediterranean Europe, due to the relatively lower population density. This made access to population groups themselves the prize, rather than the often vast amount of uncultivated land between them. With that fickleness of politics established, let's get back to the narrative. The Franks would push for extended influence over the fractured tribes of the Dinaric region, so as to maintain control of the vital mountain passes of the Eastern Alps and Slovenia, as well as to maintain access to the vital trade of the Adriatic Sea and the Danube River, which both formed a vital part of the Amber Road. Their first action to cement this influence would be to secure the Pannonian flank, by pushing south along Dalmatia. In doing so, they would push to replace the influence of the other main power in the region, Byzantium. The whole region had been under the control of the Byzantines prior to the Slavic invasions, and with them, their access to these populations had been virtually cut off. Despite this, the cities of Dalmatia and the growing city of Venice further northwest would remain remarkably loyal and continue to rule in their name. This does not mean that the Byzantines had any real control over them, however, and by all accounts, these various cities, whether they be Venice, Split, Zadar, or Dubrovnik, were all fully self-governing. They simply owed token tribute and received occasional naval assistance. The Franks would see this influence as a threat to their own access to the region, and under the March of Friuli, began to creep in. Their strategy would be to unite the Dalmatian Croats as a wall against Byzantine influence, which threatened their control of the mountain passes and the Pannonian interior. The campaigns would come off to a rough start, with the March of Friuli himself, a man named Eric, falling in battle against the Croats at the Siege of Tursat in 799. St. Paulinus would act as a source for this time, writing a lament for the loss of his friend. Despite this setback, the campaigns of Friuli would continue, and eventually they would ally with the Christian Croat, Prince Vysislav. Under Italian sponsorship, Vysislav would successfully unite most of the scattered Croatian tribes under Christian rule, which was friendly to the Franks. By 812, the Franks had successfully established their wall, and also conquered several towns along the Adriatic, including Venice itself. At a summit with the Byzantines, the Franks would trade these Roman towns back to them, along with Venice, in exchange for Byzantine recognition of their status as emperors. The Byzantines would concede, though insist on calling them Emperor of the Franks rather than Emperor of the Romans, so as to hold on to their claim to Roman universalism. This was good enough for the Franks, though, who in addition to this concession had also been allowed to maintain their overlordship over the Dalmatian and Pannonian Slavs. This is definitely not the end of Byzantine influence, however, as soon the Franks will see their own influence diminished by the many conflicts of the 9th century. The Byzantines, meanwhile, would only expand their presence, establishing the theme of Durazzo around the city in modern Albania by 800. They would base here a significant Adriatic fleet, along with Tematic soldiers from the surrounding lands. Through this presence, they would ensure increased access to their surviving Dalmatian self-governing cities, as well as to their surviving possessions in Italy. Back to the Frankish dominions, though. After the death of Charlemagne, instability would be introduced to the region. A prince known as Ludovit Posavsky, meaning Ludovit of the Sava, would succeed Prince Vojnimir in Lower Pannonia around 810, and under Frankish sponsorship would extend his reign over a group of Slavs known as the Timuch Slavs, in Sirmia and modern eastern Serbia. As a border division, Lower Pannonia would take a large amount of the action against the Bulgars, and presumably come to resent their subservient status, despite this important role many miles from the Frankish base of power. There were also stories of horrendous mistreatment of locals by the March of Friuli, mirroring the similar mistreatments from the Avar times. In response to this, Ludovit would petition the Emperor Louis to curb the March of Friuli from their abuses in 818. But receive a hostile response. So, he would rally the Timuch Slavs and the Pannonian Slavs and revolt against the Frankish authorities in 819. The revolts would start in Krain, the division of Carantania, and Ludovit would successfully unite his forces with the Carantanian and Istrian Slavs, creating a quite sizable force of most inland Slavs of the region. He would soon defeat a small force sent by the March of Friuli in 819, allowing him access to populations along the coast. Here, Ludovit would attempt to recruit the Dalmatian Croats, led by a certain Prince Borna, though Borna would ally instead with the Franks, perhaps hoping to expand into Ludovit's land after the revolt. Borna would be defeated by Ludovit, though his revolt would fail to recruit the Dalmatian Slavs, and soon be forced onto the defensive. His men would defeat a further force led by the Margrave of Friuli in 820, but this would fail to stop the overwhelming momentum of the Franks, who would push his army back into Pannonia and subdue the Carantanians. By 822, Ludovit was defeated after a brutal war of attrition in the rough swampland along the Sava. To finish his story, he would successfully escape to a Serbian settlement, likely somewhere in modern Bosnia, where he would get involved in further intrigue, eventually killing the local lord who had let him in. He would then be forced to flee and be offered refuge once again by Borna's nephew Vladislav among the Dalmatian Croats. After arriving, he would be treacherously murdered in revenge for his campaigns against Borna and against Dalmatia. The aftermath of this dramatic revolt would be a full Frankish reorganization of the region. Carantania would lose its Slavic self-rule, and instead become just another region with appointed Frankish leaders. In Pannonia, the Franks would attempt to assert further control, sending armies to re-establish influence over remaining bases of power, including the eastern Timuk Slavs of Serbia. In doing so, however, the March of Friuli would anger the Bulgars in the region, who now felt threatened by this Frankish thrust so close to their home territories. The Bulgars would send several envoys over the 820s, which were ignored, and so, in 827, they would launch a proper attack on the loosely controlled land. Several local Slavic lords would be replaced with Bulgar representatives, and they would push far along the Dinarics so as to border the Dalmatian Slavs from lands in modern Bosnia and Croatia. Here, they would launch raids into Dalmatia and Italian borderlands itself, fully threatening all of the Frankish gains. The Bulgars likely now controlled a large part of Lower Pannonia as well, though it did not extend much further north than Slavonia. Louis the Pious, in response to this, would punish the March of Friuli by taking away its overlordship of these Dinaric conquests, and granting them all instead to the future lords of East Francia, as originally outlined in his 817 succession treaty. The reforms of 828 and the 830s would also abolish the Christian Avar self-rule, instead replacing it under the Frankish March of Pannonia, which itself was under the rule of Bavaria. Here, fortifications would be made to protect from the Bulgars and the Moravians, a different rising Slavic power, which threatened the Frankish control of Pannonia. The Moravians would form the primary threat to the region from the Bavarian point of view, and Great Moravia, as they will become known, will be focused on further next series. To finish Frankish reorganization of the region, though, the former Carantanians would eventually evolve into the March of Carinthia, also under the Bavarians, and fortified against the Bulgars and the anarchy of Pannonia. It is from this militaristic power base that the later Arnulf of Carinthia would be able to establish control over the entirety of East Francia later in the 880s. With that reorganization, seeing how Pannonia is now teeming with them, it's time to talk about what a march is, and what made them unique from other administrative divisions. As we discussed before, the primary mode of control was in allowing access to certain trade routes, or contacts you wanted to maintain influence over. Given how sparsely populated much of Europe was at the time, and the amount of potential enemies encircling any given realm, a march was a way to protect access further inland, essentially by sacrificing access to the resources of the borderland itself. A military commander on a similar level to a duke, known as a margrave, or marcher lord, would lead a realm focused on frontier defense and expansion. As a margrave, he would possess privileges not given to lords which were safely within the realm. The biggest one was increased autonomy. As the ruler's retinue was too small of a professional force to patrol the borderlands regularly, a margrave would need to have the power to make their own decisions with their own resources, without always asking permission. Given the preference of military forces at the time to raid rather than conquer, this was especially important, as a quick response was needed to respond at all. Internally, military forces were organized differently as well. The margrave was able to assume the power to summon locals to build and maintain fortifications to protect strategically important areas. Within the wide array of new fortifications, a constant force would also be maintained to garrison and patrol. These men would then be able to double up as rapid response units. Over the course of the Middle Ages, the fortification of the countryside would really pick up. Within Inner Europe, this was less so within the plateau, but more true on the borders with Carpathia and the Riverlands. A large amount of these fortifications were sprung in the 9th and 10th centuries, during these times of instability, specifically within those border marches. Fortification also picked up on the other side of the border in response to this, with Moravia being a great example of a state next to a march which fortified itself in response to its increased military capabilities. The need to provide for the region's own defenses often necessitated a larger grant of land than other dukedoms, and margraves themselves would add to this advantage by conquering additional land for themselves if they were able. It was not uncommon, then, for marches to form sub-realms of their own, with their own major vassals and even further marches. Bavaria is an example of a duchy formed largely as a march, but who would, during the 9th century, expand to create marches of its own in Pannonia and Carinthia? This vast amount of land, combined with increased autonomy and a larger potential for mobilization, meant that margraves were often a serious player within the internal politics of a realm. This proved even more so, as they too were granted hereditary clan rights slowly over time. Within the Dinaric region we've been discussing, almost every piece of land was organized as a march. The East Franks had the marches of Carinthia and Pannonia established in order to protect their access to Italy, specifically the Brenner Pass near Innsbruck. Italy would be a source of both trade, legitimacy, and potential subjects for lords of the plateau, and so fortifying their flanks would be of great importance. Within Italy itself, by the 9th century, almost the entire peninsula had been organized into marches. This was due to the increase in Arab raids and even conquest made during the period. It wasn't long before every town had its own fort. And speaking of Italy, let's get back to the narrative. The Dalmatian Croats had largely come out on top from all the Pannonian instability, as they had successfully used Frankish sponsorship to unite the Slavs of Dalmatia, and even made small inroads into the Dinaric passes to Pannonia. With the Frankish succession crises following the death of Louis the Pious in 840, the Franks would turn inward, allowing these Croats to loosen the German grip. Also helping with this task would be the Byzantine resurgence into the area during the same period. After establishing a naval presence through the team of Durazzo in the south, they had re-established connections to the Roman towns of Dalmatia and Venice. The Adriatic Sea at the time was almost unsailable due to the high amounts of piracy. Hostile ships in the area ranged from Arab ships, which posed the most serious threat, to Dalmatian Croat forces, which continued to engage in extortion and piracy, despite pleas from the Pope to stop, and a different group of Croats known as the Nerazzurri. The Nerazzurri were still pagan and based out of the swamps of the Neretva River Delta in modern southern Croatia and Bosnia. They became feared pirates of the time, and specific enemies of the Venetians. Further increasing their menace, they would even ally with other forces in the region, at times including Dubrovnik, and worryingly, the Arabs. Into this mess, the Byzantines would slowly work to retake control. Slowly, they would improve relations with the various powers. The tribute owed by the Dalmatian cities would be allowed to be redirected to the Dalmatian Croats in exchange for their ceasing to piracy. This, combined with papal contacts to their duchy to calm their piracy, would also end up strengthening them as an independent buffer to the Franks. In 867, the Arabs would build up a strong enough presence to attempt to take Dubrovnik. After a 15-month siege, the Byzantines would successfully break the siege, greatly improving their influence across the entire region. They would follow this up with the establishment of a formal theme of Dalmatia, complete with a strategos sent from Constantinople. The nature of this theme was unique from all other Byzantine themes, and mostly corresponded to providing naval guidance, with internal affairs still largely left to the Dalmatian cities. Croatian ties to the Byzantines would be shown more clearly when in 871 they contributed ships and marines to a successful Byzantine campaign to retake Bari, a city on the South Italian coast. With Byzantine backing, the Croats would now be empowered enough to push for full independence from the Franks. In 875, Louis the German would die, and Carloman, the new ruler of Bavaria, would push for closer integration of Croatia as part of his new administration. The Dalmatian Croats would reject this and launch a full-scale revolt with subtle Byzantine aid. United under a militaristic prince known as Domagoj, they would successfully defeat Frankish response armies sent against them and claim their full independence. They would even push for further concessions by invading Istria, but the city of Venice would intervene to stop them. This would be one of the first entries in a rivalry between Venice and the Croats, as although under Byzantine overlordship, the Venetians would quickly rise to become a dominant power in the Adriatic in their own right. Already, they had united the scattered islands of their lagoon into a republic led by a doge, their term for duke. Their prestige was further bolstered by the Patriarchate of Grado, a competing administration to the Patriarch of Aquileia, more friendly to the Byzantines and Venetians, as well as by their recent acquisition of the body of the Apostle St. Mark. His body had been smuggled out of Alexandria in the 820s by Venetian traders, a task which was carefully accomplished by hiding his remains in port, which the Muslim toll officers could not rifle through. In time, they would work to subsume the other Dalmatian cities. For now, though, victory was to the Dalmatian Croats, who had achieved their independence. They were soon recognized by the Pope in Rome as an independent state, locking in their new status. The following decades would see much turmoil and succession, featuring a legitimate Turpimirovich dynasty and several challengers centered around the line of Domagoj, who had been the one to achieve independence. Eventually, however, the legitimate Turpimirovich dynasty would win out, and by 914, the great leader Tomislav would rule. This would be the times of the Magyar invasions, as mentioned last episode, and although threatening the Croats greatly, it would also present an opportunity. To examine that opportunity, and to finish off our story, we return to where it all began, along the River Sava. After the chaos and anarchy of Ludovic's rebellion, Frankish reorganization, and Bulgar invasion, control by any large power was very weak. In the 840s, Bavarian Franks would march in and subjugate a local Slavic lord, granting his title to a loyal adventurer from Moravia named Prince Pribina. Pribina had been the Duke of Nitra, and we'll meet up again in our episode on Great Moravia, but in this latter half of his story, he would work to build what will become known as the Duchy of Lower Pannonia. During the reign of Prince Ludovic in the region, several strategic points had been fortified, with even Italian specialists being brought in to construct the most up-to-date castles dotting the countryside. Pribina would now use this to establish a defensive state, loyal to the Franks but with significant autonomy. He would base his administration out of a new town which sprang up besides one of these forts. This town would come to be known as Blatnograd, at the southern end of Lake Balaton in modern Hungary. Pribina's new state would be important in that it would act as a Slavic bridge, with Germans to the west and Bulgars who were still not fully Slavicized to the east. Blatnograd could act as an intermediate point between the Christian Slavic stronghold of Moravia in the north and Croatia in the south. This would be of importance to the missions of Cyril and Methodius, something else we will discuss soon enough. But to finally reunite with our story, Lower Pannonia would eventually become tied to the Franks in wars against the Moravians, and be granted more land along the Danube as a result. These wars would also help to bring the Magyar to Pannonia, though, and once their conquest began in full, the Duchy of Pannonia would dissolve from its political order. Some even claimed that the climactic Battle of Pressburg, which we discussed last episode, actually happened at the gates of Blatnograd itself, sealing the conquest of this would-be Slavic capital. All was not lost for the Pannonian Slavs, however, as the extensive fortifications of their land in Slavonia would delay the Magyar from fully conquering their land. In desperation, Slavonians would appeal to the Dalmatian Croats, now led by Tomislav, to subjugate them in exchange for protection. Tomislav would graciously accept, granting them significant autonomy, which would remain far into the future. By the banks of the Drava River, Tomislav would lead a combined Croat and Slavonian force against the Magyar in 925, and defeat them in a momentous battle. Following this expansion and victory, Tomislav would be granted the title of King of the Croats, and have it affirmed by the Pope himself. And with this dramatic occasion, we will leave the episode here for today. We will return to the now King Tomislav next series as well, as his lands would soon be targeted by the now Imperial Bulgars to the east. But that is enough for this series. Europe had changed almost completely since the times before Charlemagne's conquest, and an entirely new aristocratic and church-led order had settled across the land. It was only a matter of time before the developments and tools spread from these small areas on the plateau in Carpathia to encompass the entirety of inner Europe. And next series will be about just this, as new states struggle to find their identity in these rapidly dynamic times. It will be a time of trial and error. Thank you for listening to Between the Seas. I enjoyed putting this episode together, as it covers a relatively little-known part of inner Europe's history. With it is the start of the story for all three episodes of the next series, each picking up a different loose end. And with that, this has been Jacob, and I hope that you can carry with you today the confidence and autonomy of a Margrave.